settle back in. We're going to journey on through our presentation. And I would like to again say thanks to all of our supporters tonight. And we are going to continue putting these events on. If you would like to be notified of these events, please sign up in the back in the entrance as you leave so you can get an email announcement. But at this point, grab a couple slices of pizza pie and a refill and settle on in. We're going to charge ahead. So with that, we would like to continue this conversation about low-impact development and some of the opportunities and projects that are happening here in our county. So if you would, come on in. Our next speaker is a lead with one of the agencies in our area that does quite a bit of work, the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And Mr. Dominic Rock is actually one of their lead in watershed restoration projects, which in our area there's quite a bit of watersheds, and there's an endless supply of work and effort that goes into those watersheds. And I think it's an exciting line of profession, and I recommend anyone who's going to select a profession that watershed restoration is a really exciting one and a worthwhile endeavor for our society. So I'm very pleased to bring up Mr. Dominic. And Foyeon, he is actually going to transition into our third speaker for the night, Darla, and the two of them will carry on together as a duo. So Dominic Rock from the Regional Water Board.
Thank you, Noah. I appreciate the introduction, the welcome, and the opportunity to speak with you guys tonight. I don't know if we're going to do lights at some point, but I'll go ahead and start, and if you want to cut the lights, that's fine. Wow. Okay, so there's a couple of parts to my talk tonight. The first is to break a glass. And the first part is about watersheds and what they are and how they function. And then I want to talk about how issues of scale relate to the way that we approach solving problems with watersheds. So what is a watershed? It's a geographical area that's drained by a distinct... This is a rowdy crowd. I'll just speak up. So it's a geographic area that's drained by a distinct river or a stream separated by a ridgetop boundary. So in this case, it's a fairly large watershed. You can see that you could probably take this one stream here and create a second watershed boundary around it. But the point is that, you know, it's this basin scale geographic area. And when people talk about watersheds, they might emphasize a different thing. They might emphasize water, or they might emphasize, you know, the geographic basin, the land uses within it. But the thing to remember, it's really a concept that applies to all of these things together, the basin, the soil, the vegetation, the people, the cities that live within them. And the principal role that surface, that basin plays is to convey surface water through a network of ephemeral, intermittent, and perennial streams. These ephemeral streams, like the one I have in the picture of California Valley, took a couple of weeks ago, they flow briefly and they flow in direct response to rain events that occur within the watershed or nearby. The intermittent stream is going to flow throughout portions of the year, the wet season, and this is a picture of one in the Morro Bay watershed. And then perennial streams are going to flow perennially, constantly. And this is an example from the San Antonio River up in the northern part of, or southern part of Monterey County. So all these rivers are, and all these water bodies are flowing in response to rainfall. And I've got an image here just to convey the context for rainfall within the Central Coast region. I guess the sound just got a little better, huh? So what I've done is I have outlined the Central Coast region there just to give you an idea of the relative rainfall patterns throughout this region as compared to the rest of the arid west. And what you'll find is that in the Central Coast region, we actually have a hydrology and a rainfall pattern that's closer resembling parts of Arizona and New Mexico than it is to other parts of our own state, in spite of the fact that we live right on the ocean. So just as an example of how a water actually flows through a watershed, I thought this was a really excellent composite slide that I borrowed from Dr. Stone at the Dr. Mark Stone at the Desert Research Institute. And what it shows, is this in this little graph here. That's basically a rainfall event. It measures rainfall intensity along the y-axis and elapsed time along the x-axis. And it's a fairly brief rain event. It was only 30 minutes long. It occurred in the upper part of the watershed. And as it flows through the watershed, we can see what happens to the flow rate and to the volume of flow as it moves through. This first flume is the rain gauge that corresponds with this graph over here. This is a storm hydrograph, and what it represents is the discharge as it relates to time. And just within 30 minutes, there was enough rainfall runoff to produce a peak at over 100 cubic meters per second with a considerable volume of 250,000 cubic meters or so. And as it flowed through past flume 2 and all the way to the mouth of the watershed, we see that peak has decreased significantly. The rate is down to 55 cubic meters per second as opposed to over 100, and the volume is closer to 155,000 as opposed to 246. And what this conveys is the very real effect of the sponginess of watersheds. Where does all that water go if it doesn't make its way through the mouth of the watershed? Well, of course, a lot of it is going to go up into evapotranspiration or evaporation throughout the landscape. But there's also going to be storage and ponds and lakes and all. But a substantial portion will definitely go into the ground. How does it get there? Well, of course, it's going to go straight. It's going to go straight into the ground through these surface recharge zones. And they might be artificial, such as in the case of this pond, which is allowing water to infiltrate into the aquifer. But note that there's also this important conduit of surface water into the ground, and that's our rivers and our streams. In our region in particular, the streams and the channels themselves are major conduits of surface water into the ground. So we've talked about surface water and groundwater. Next thing that watersheds do so well is they move sediment. It's really the work of streams and rivers to move sediment. And they do this according to a natural disturbance regime. They do it with cycles of large floods that cause channel widening, followed by long periods of more modest floods and more modest flow that do nothing but really narrow the channel and incise it deeper into the landscape. Even in this image of area around Paso Robles, you can see that there's this carving effect of the streams in the watershed. The bottom line about this is that there's really this balance that's occurring. And over time, a channel will actually seek an equilibrium between the water that flows through it and the sediment that it's trying to carry. This diagram that was produced by Lane back in 1955 is just incredible. It will be something we're looking at in 150 years, I'm sure, because it's so clear what it illustrates. Basically, it expresses this relationship between sediment and water. And if you imagine reducing the amount of sediment on this pan, which way is the scale going to tip? It's going to go to the right? And this little arrow here is going to go this way, which tells you that degradation or erosion is going to start occurring. If we reverse that and we actually rob the stream of its water flow, if we divert some of that flow, or if we have a climatic shift and we have less flow, this thing is actually going to go this way. So we're going to see aggradation, more accumulated sediment within the system. The key to remember is that there's this effort for the stream to be in balance, to balance the sediment load and the sediment size with the stream discharge and the stream slope. And that relationship bears through, and effectively what it is a conservation of energy. The stream is always looking for its lowest energy state. Now, a lot of people will look at these functions of surface groundwater and sediment transport as evidence of a healthy watershed, or the jobs that a healthy watershed will function as or perform. They'll capture sediment. It'll capture transport flows of water. It'll recharge groundwater. It'll move sediment around, and it'll sustain habitat. And in fact, habitat really derives from the interactions between surface groundwater and sediment in a watershed. And it does this according to that disturbance regime, natural disturbance regime, or potentially an unnatural one. And it does it in a dynamic equilibrium, just like that balance diagram illustrated. There's this constant effort to achieve an equilibrium. So we have to ask ourselves what happens to that equilibrium when we develop the landscape. Well, clearly, there's going to be some transformation between the left side of the screen and the right side of the screen. But what is that? Let's take one example of habitat fragmentation. Habitat fragmentation isolates wildlife, and it acts as a migration barrier. And it does this other thing, which is to promote invasive species. Now, why and how does that happen? Well, when we lose floodplain connectivity, the connection between the stream and the watershed itself, that physical connection between water body and landscape, we start to interrupt the processes that govern the natural disturbance regime. And one of those processes is the process of riparian plant recruitment. So we've interrupted through disconnecting the landscape from the stream, a process that's going to result in it's kind of a negative feedback situation. You're not going to get the reestablishment of a riparian zone until you reconnect the landscape to the stream. This leads us to the conclusion, really, that the best way to manage water resources and aquatic and riparian habitat is from the watershed level. But what does that mean? Watersheds are big, they're small, they're nested within each other. So that's where this issue of scale comes in. And there was a few distractions at the beginning of the presentation, but I wanted to talk about watersheds and how they function, and then I want to talk about how scale relates to our approach to managing watersheds. So this is just an example. I don't know whether it washed out or not, but you know, these systems are nested within each other. So within the Central Coast region, which is this red area, here's Monterey Bay and Morro Bay and the coast of Santa Barbara down here. We have 13 watersheds that we can say that the region is broken into 13 watersheds, the Salinas River being the largest of those. But we could also break it out further. We could break the Salinas River into 14 sub-watersheds and the region into 99. Or we could go another step and break out the region into 418 watersheds, in which case the Salinas River, I didn't outline it, but it would have 100 sub-watersheds. Or we could go whole hog, you know, just go hog wild and keep breaking out watersheds to correspond with every little stream, and we'd end up with over 1,500 watersheds. This awareness of scale is really critical to the way that we approach a variety of environmental problems, not just water quality and water supply problems. It really frames how we're scaling or how we're addressing problems in terms of where, when, and how. It translates into the questions that we ask, the analysis that we conduct, and the solutions that we ultimately deliver. A good example of this would be the water supply. So the water supply challenge, which is to increase our supply over time or maintain it. And in this case, water supply can be sort of framed according to the spatial scales that I've mentioned. Let's look at groundwater recharge. If that's our proposed enhancement strategy, we already know that groundwater recharge is highly variable across the landscape. So we need to identify where the best recharge areas are. As I pointed out, in our region, a lot of those recharge areas are actually the streams themselves. But there are other parts of the landscape. The point is it's heterogeneous, and we have to know precisely the spatial scale at which recharge is an option. When we look at conservation strategies, we can look at retrofitting shower heads and toilets and applying kind of a conservation strategy at that household scale, business scale, or we can use price signals. We can change the rate that water is purchased at, and we can actually have a much broader impact across a much wider spectrum of the economy and address industrial and even agricultural scale consumption of water. When we look at rainfall capture and gray water systems in homes, those are actually offsetting the potential impacts of a larger scale water project that might be needed if we didn't do those things. So clearly, issue of scale is a big part of our water supply question. There's really not a single water quality issue that I can think of that wouldn't benefit from a comprehension or an understanding of the spatial scale. As an example, the effects, if we wanted to look at the effects of land use on surface flows and riparian habitat, we're not going to just jump into this mess of water bodies throughout the region. This is all the water bodies. I showed you that map of watersheds Well, these are the water beds, water bodies that they serve or that they drain to. We need to actually carve out little portions of this watershed network, in order to address this kind of a problem. So we might look at the 200 meters on either side of these particular stream reaches up in the Santa Cruz area to actually start to zero in on the relevant scale for that water quality issue. But there's another a story, really, I wanted to share with you that I learned about from a book that was written by Stephen Johnson. I don't know if anyone has read Ghost Map, but it's this really fantastic book about mid-1800s London. Back in the mid-1800s, London was over 12 million people. It was actually the largest human settlement in the history of mankind at that point. And unfortunately, it possessed really kind of an old-style, rural-scale waste management approach. People were actually just pouring their waste into the basements of buildings and creating cesspools that were full of liquid waste, like 3 and 4 feet deep. The smell was absolutely horrendous. And, of course, the sanitation conditions associated with that were abysmal. It basically threatened the very experiment of this large-scale human settlement that they were trying to do in London. And there was a doctor named John Snow who observed that these cholera epidemics were occurring, you know, every 4 or 5 years and just wiping out thousands of people at a time. This was really, the experiment was on the verge of failure due to cholera outbreaks. And he was convinced that there was a waterborne sort of a point source to this epidemic, to these diseases. They didn't have the microbiological techniques to go out and find the pathogen. They were working with all kinds of crazy theories. And what he did on some hot August night in 1854, a little girl, they called her Baby Louise, she contracted cholera. And she lived right next to the pump on Broad Street, which is right here. And she succumbed, of course. And within 7 days, 10% of the neighborhood died. Thousands of people were dead. And what John Snow did was he took the handle off the pump without really anyone understanding why. And, of course, the epidemic subsided. But then he was confronted by all these people who wanted their water back. And he was confronted by people who actually thought that the diseases were transmitted by this smell. They called them the miasmists. The people believed that the disease was coming from this miasma. And he had to confront this kind of religious belief that it was coming from a airborne source. And he did something remarkable. He started mapping. He started using spatial information to convince people that there really was a point source. You can tell that the pump is here, and if each black bar represents a death, that as you move away from the pump, the number of deaths decreases. He combined the spatial information with the conventional approach, which was to present tables and numbers, and he eventually convinced people. And in 1866, when the next big epidemic was occurring, the officials in London bought into his idea, and they asked people to boil water. And from that point on, epidemic-scale cholera was never really a problem again in London. I think this is a really interesting story, and I think it demonstrates how an awareness of spatial dimensions of a crisis can affect the questions we ask, how we analyze those problems, and ultimately on the solutions. I think it took a map, really an expression of spatial information, to save London. If we move from that historical perspective kind of through this temporal, into this temporal scale, we'll start with climate change, which I can't possibly do justice to, but I wanted to bring it up because there's no other issue in our lives that has made spatial and temporal scales more relevant, more meaningful to people than climate change. For the first time, people are thinking on much longer time frames about when the climate's going to change, how long it's been changing, and they're also thinking on a planetary scale about the effects of climate change. But just in the case of this particular example, this is Morro Bay, where Highway 41 comes into the one. There's the high school up here and the power plant down here. The power plant. And this just is from the Pacific Institute's recent study on the impacts of climate change on sea level rise on the California coast. And it shows the difference between today, which is in light blue, representing that 100-year storm surge that would make its way up across the beach and possibly into some of the infrastructure-built areas. But what would happen after 55 inches of sea level rise by the year 2100, which is what is predicted? And we see a dark blue pattern emerging here. So we actually see that storm surge would lap up against the west edge of the high school's soccer field. Now, another way that the temporal scale becomes crucial to folks in this environmental business is that we have to always ask ourselves what our goals are for environmental restoration. Well, there's been a lot of really evil and, you know, devious things that have been done in the past. Of course, people did them with the best of intentions. But this is an example from an advertisement from a Forester's magazine back in 1915. And I don't think you can read it, but it says that, it says how dynamite streamlines streams. And it says, let me read a couple of lines here. Crooked streams are a menace to life and crops in the areas bordering their banks. Dynamite may be used most efficiently and economically in taking the kinks out of crooked streams. DuPont Dynamite has straightened thousands of miles of crooked streams. DuPont has an explosive for every use. So when we see things like this, it might send chills up your spine, and you might hope that the thousands of miles of straightened streams is an exaggeration. But the truth is that we really do have to confront this question of how to restore these systems. What's the best approach? Are we going to go in there and try to reproduce the habitat elements like large wood and pools and cover and gravel deposits and overhanging vegetation? Are we going to go in and try to actually restore the processes, the hydrologic, ecological processes that generate and sustain those elements? Those are two totally different things. They're really things that happen on a short term or a long term. And we're constrained, of course. We don't live in a perfect world. We're really constrained by how far we can go in different environments. But if this is the problem that we confront with restoration, don't you think it should also be the temporal consideration we give to how and what we want to protect? Certainly, we want to protect the processes, the hydrologic, the ecological processes. LID is a good example of a way to develop the landscape that takes that into consideration. Another temporal shift occurs when we move between the spatial context of surface water and that of groundwater. And that's simply because water moves through surface at meters per second, but it moves through the ground at meters per day or even longer. I recently was able to attend a lecture by John Isbicki, a USGS geologist who's been studying the alluvial fans that come off of the north side of the San Bernardino Mountains. And in those alluvial fans, there'll be maybe a 420 acre feet of water that will flow on an annual basis through these washes. About 60 acre feet will actually make it into the groundwater. And of that 60 acre feet, it'll take it 400 years, according to his modeling. And he's modeled it like 12 different ways. So I think his numbers are good. It'll be 400 years before that water actually makes its way into the aquifer. And this is the aquifer that's really the drinking water source for the entire area there. The point of this is that groundwater really is, it's like a fossil fuel. It's a resource that's been that's you can't really replace once you remove it. The time scales at which you can recharge it are incredibly slow. Another example of the temporal variability issue is really with respect to our Mediterranean climate, which we're both blessed and cursed by here on the Central Coast. And this is an example from the California Valley. If you look at this picture of a culvert underneath a road, you can see over here there's kind of this declivity, and that's really the drainage that comes through this culvert underneath the road. There's not really much of a channel form there, and it is a fairly dry area out there, as you know. But if I were to turn around, which I did, and take this picture, you can see that there's actually an effect of natural variability that you could say was underestimated by the folks who built that road. At this point, they're actually trying to address this problem by placing a lot of concrete in the road to just address and to arrest this process, which is something they've started and they can't seem to stop. And just to give you a better perspective on it, this over here is a car. That little thing is a car. And so the scale of that concrete is pretty significant. Again, upstream, there's really no channel, well-defined channel. Downstream, there's a significantly well-defined channel. So Thomas Friedman, the newspaper columnist, had a column this Sunday in the New York Times, and he observed that, about now, folks are probably saying to themselves, you know, when my 401k is collapsing, it's hard to worry about my sea level rising. And he's got a point. We all have to make some choices about how we engage. We don't want to waste our time. We want to feel like we're making a difference. And so this scale of social scale, as I call it, is really the scale of human endeavor. And the point is that there's a variety of ways in which you can interact with watershed health or sustainability issues, climate change, and that there's no right or wrong way. It's just you need to pick one, know the context you're operating in, and kind of respect the choices of others. You might choose to work at the individual level where you redefine what reduce, reuse, recycle means. You might become a local bore. Or you might move in the collective direction and work with grassroots organizations to really create the social revolution, as Neville Slade calls it, of sustainability, which has been initiated by literally thousands of organizations at the grassroots level. In our environment here in SLO County, there really aren't that many grassroots level stream and creek organizations. Most of that activity is being done at a government or quasi-governmental level. The Morro Bay National Estuary Program is an example of a watershed approach, a watershed program that's really comprehensive in its scope, but it definitely brings in stakeholders from the community, but it's clearly driven by government and quasi-governmental sources and resources. Another is the SLO Sea, the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance. And they have a beautiful vision, of a healthy, resilient ecosystem along the coast here. But they're taking into account Cape, all of the Morro Bay watershed, and then they're reaching out into the marine environment to take everything from Cape San Martin down to Point Conception, I believe. So it's a very broad vision. It's a very sophisticated approach of scientists, resource managers, and stakeholders. Another government-sponsored approach using watersheds is this effort by the Caltrans, Department of Transportation, which I've had a chance to be a part of. And we're creating this watershed approach to selecting mitigation sites for future transportation projects. And this represents a model that I think could be replicated throughout San Luis and throughout the Central Coast, really, because it's a future-oriented approach to get some of the mitigation sites before they're too expensive to purchase. How many people here work for government? Is there anyone willing to raise their hand? It's not as many as I thought, but there's a few of you. I think while government is and should be conceived of as a human endeavor, we have to recognize the scale of that effort. We have to recognize when we have expectations of government and we have questions for government, we really need to take into account the scale of those endeavors. And so I wanted to use the Central Coast Water Board just as an example of sort of a medium-scale human endeavor. It's 75 people. They're serving a population of 1.4 million, and they're covering an area of 11,000 square miles. Now, the folks who work in an agency with that kind of a mandate for protecting water quality on a scale that big really have to think about efficiencies and making the best use of their time. And currently, the Central Coast Water Board has embraced a vision of healthy watersheds. And the idea of that is to actually start down a path, a crooked path that we might give DuPont a call about later, but it's a crooked path and it's going to take time to get down. But the point is we're actually trying to redefine a lot of what we do with a goal, a very clear goal, with measurable goals that include healthy aquatic habitat, clean groundwater, and sustainable land use. And we have measurable goals that are going to be literally be measurable by the year 2025. But just wanted to present that as an example of how the human scale of our endeavors is really worth thinking about long and hard. To use the Central Coast Water Board kind of as a way to summarize scale, I'm actually going to read this because it's kind of wordy. But you could say that the Central Coast Water Board, as a social organization, is working at a given scale of 75 people for 1.4 million, using watersheds of varying spatial scales across this 11,000 square mile area to frame its approach, that is to identify the questions and the type of analysis that we're conducting, to protect and restore water quality as it responds to the short and the long-term effects of human settlement. You might try to apply this spatial, temporal, and social scale framework to one of your own little problems. See how it works. The last example, though, I wanted to give was of the evolution of stormwater management. I believe that this evolution actually is emblematic of a shift in awareness of scale. We really started this process of evolution of stormwater management by focusing on one thing and one thing only, and that was to prevent flooding of a particular environment, the city or the agricultural lands, and its very specific function to protect public health and property. The problem was there were consequences to that, and they included a miscalculation maybe of the actual effects that creating impervious surface or straightening streams was going to have on the downstream environment. And what people concluded was that it was the peaks, these new runoff peaks were causing all these problems. And so that the subsequent phase of stormwater management really focused on managing peaks with these, you know, detention basins and underground vaults. And there were some water quality benefits that could be attained from that as well. But the problem with these peaks with these detention basins, which are placed at the base of developments like this, is they don't really affect the amount of volume being generated by this landscape. They don't reduce it. They might reduce it a bit through percolation, but in general, the increased volume from this large-scale imperviousness is not addressed by detention. It's just slowed down. And of course, increased runoff volume is going to affect watershed health. It's going to reduce your habitat value, reduce your recharge of your groundwater, increase your stream temperatures, increase the pollutant loading. So the final stage of our evolution is to actually mimic the natural hydrology. Go back to what the watershed can do for you. It can be the sponge. It can retain and transport the sediment, recharge the groundwater, store and convey water, surface water, and it can give you habitat benefits of filtration and water quality protection. So we went from this pre-development condition. We developed with flood control, and we developed with peak control, and we're currently in the era of stormwater management that's striving to mimic the original pre-development condition as closely as we can to protect the watershed. So again, I think this is an example of a shift that has occurred, a spatial shift. We've seen the spatial shift that is from a point source, get this water, this flood out of here, to a watershed scale where we're actually harnessing the hydrologic processes that govern surface runoff and groundwater recharge and sediment transport and habitat. And we've seen a temporal scale shift from that static system where we've really underestimated the natural variability of some of these systems to really understanding it, appreciating it, and even considering long-term effects like climate change. And then finally, in the social scheme, there's a big shift happening between the centralized approach, you know, detention basins, big end-of-the-pipe treatment systems, to a decentralized approach. The sustainable model for stormwater places an enormous amount of emphasis on the individual behaviors and actions and less emphasis on sort of centralized government-sponsored and funded treatment works and detention facilities. Healthy watersheds are a cornerstone of sustainability. I really believe this. I hope that I can convince you of this. In the book E.F. Schumacher wrote back, and they require that they require action at a whole variety of scales of individual and collective human endeavor. I really think that healthy watersheds are a key principle for organizing what is ultimately, at its core, a social task of leaving the world a better place for future generations. Thank you. Do we have Darla in the house? Darla Inglis.
I think we're ready for the lights again, actually. That was quick. Thanks, Dominic. So welcome. I hope you're enjoying yourselves. Thank you for coming to support the vision of a healthy watershed, oceans, lakes, streams, estuaries, etc. I want to thank the Appropriate Technology Coalition for inviting me to speak with you about low-impact development and the role of low-impact development in stormwater management, as well as sort of the ripple effect of stormwater management into things like water supply, et cetera. While Dominic was ending his presentation with some of those very nice quotes, it struck me that I wonder if we really realize how far we've come environmentally. It was only a little over 40 years ago, 45 years ago, that Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring and all the horrible things that were happening to the environment because of the pollutants in the environment. It was only about 50 years ago or so that we still had rivers catching fire because of all the pollutants that were in rivers, and essentially our rivers were flammable. So we've come a tremendous way, and I think that we should all acknowledge how far we've come. I think we're entering a new paradigm in terms of how we look at the environment, and part of that paradigm is that the environment isn't really this separate thing that we talk about and separate work that we do. It's really integrated into the economic and social fabric, all the things that make a sustainable watershed. And you're starting to see terms that I think allude to that kind of more integrative thinking. It's new urbanism, it's smart growth, it's green build, and it's low impact development, which I said I'm talking about today. So this is all very good. So while I'll be talking about things that we could be doing and should be doing, we should also be thinking about how far we've come. I really need to go back a few centuries to start my conversation a bit with René Descartes, who is a French philosopher. And he is the person that we can blame or thank for the way that we think. René Descartes was considered the father of modern philosophy and brought about what was called the mechanistic view of the world, a very linear sort of view of the world. Before all the little springs, you can start understanding how that clock works. So this concept at the time was absolutely revolutionary and changed the face of how we looked at medicine, how we looked at science and technology. And it was really that thinking and his thinking that took on that essentially created the breach between Western civilization and Eastern civilization, or cultures or thinking. Again, the Western being much more linear, much more mechanistic, and what the Eastern thinking still being much more organic and sort of whole system based. And many authors have attributed the fact, this that happened with Descartes, that for many generations, Asian cultures, for example, were not as technologically advanced because they couldn't think in that linear way. They were still thinking very organically. And why the Western nations, Europe and the United States, et cetera, started becoming much more advanced technologically. Well, we know the kinds of downfalls that go with that, and you can look at medicine. I mean, we've made great strides in medicine with sort of a linear, mechanistic approach. We're more curing symptoms than causes oftentimes, but it's very much breaking down kind of the medicine of the human body, whereas Eastern medicine tends to look more kind of causally and whole at the system. And why am I talking about all this? Well, we think like this. We may not know that we think like this, but we think like this now. And when we look at how we manage water and how we manage the environment, we really have a very linear mechanistic model right now. We are taking apart the clock, so to speak, when we're looking at environmental issues. So you've got these silos. There's lots more, but I'm putting examples down. There's the silos of stormwater, water supply, groundwater, wastewater, climate change, and energy. And we've made great strides in each one of those silos. The limitation right now is that all of our laws and regulations are pretty much set up to function within the silos. You've got groundwater laws, you've got stormwater laws, and it's been very hard to look at all these pieces as an integrated whole, as a watershed. And you were starting to hear a lot of that from Dominic about the vision of a healthy watershed is really a lot about integration. So we need to integrate all these pieces and others that I did not list more into a watershed model. What I'm going to be doing is talking specifically about stormwater and low-impact development, and then I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about how low-impact development, as it addresses stormwater, also has these other benefits like water supply. So stormwater management, I'm repeating a little bit about what Dominic says, and we'll say that that's reinforcing the points, bringing them home. But we've changed the hydrology of our landscape drastically. If you look here on the left, this could be considered a natural pre-urban condition where you've got a lot of vegetation, you've got a nice thick duff layer, nice healthy soil layer, and most of your rain when it falls down is going through the vegetation by thoroughfare, and it's kind of a lag time where the raindrop is kind of moving around through the leaves and branches, and it takes a while before it actually hits the ground. Some of the water is actually evapotranspirating from the ground and from the vegetation. A lot of it is infiltrating. That is that you start getting less evapotranspiration, less infiltration and inner flow and base flow, and the amount of surface runoff increases significantly, hugely. How many people have been in a street or a parking lot and it's rainy, you can kind of see the water flowing over the street or the parking lot? Yeah. How many of you have been in a really nice forest area and have seen water moving across? Very few situations. Generally, you do not see surface flow in nice, pristine areas. I mean, there's definitely the flash flood, kind of arroyo situations in the southwest and other areas. But when you've got a nice vegetated area with a lot of duff, it's sponging up and taking that water, and you really don't see that water flowing. So we've really altered this landscape. The impacts of that is that we get flooding, public property and safety, so street flooding, building floodings. We also have these very high volumes of surface runoff going really fast. It's just booking along because it's going across that hard concrete or street, entering into, if you can believe, this is a creek in Seattle. That can you imagine trying to be a fish or something living in there? And can you imagine how much that system is just getting blown out by all that flow? And we also get water pollutants that are conveyed with that surface runoff. All the pollutants that we're generating are moving along with that water and getting into our receiving waters, beach closures because of fecal coliform, oils and greases, metals, you name it. And one thing that I wanted to point out is that urban impervious surfaces are pretty much equal everywhere, meaning if you look at an industrial area, a commercial area, and a suburban residential area, the amount of impervious surface is actually very close. They don't differ a great amount. People generally think, oh, suburban area is nothing like an industrial area. But the amount of runoff is generally about the same, and the type of pollutants are generally about the same. I mean, there's some bad actor industries out there where you get some point sources, but It's very much equal. So whether you're in a big town, a small town, you get about the same amount of negative impact to our waters given these different land use types. And the reason being roadways. Roadways take up, of impervious surface areas, roadways generally take up about 70% of impervious surface. So you've got the blocks going around in a suburban area in our neighborhoods. You've got the same thing in a commercial district, and you've got the same thing in the industry. So the roads take up a huge amount, and most of the pollution that comes from our urban and impervious surfaces are those that are associated with automobiles. So I point this out because as we talk about different low-impact techniques and ways to approach the problems, don't get caught up in thinking, oh, suburban areas are maybe a little bit cleaner or we don't have so much to do. It's about as high of an impact as very metropolitan, high-density areas. Dominic just showed this slide about the progression of stormwater management. Again, the point being that we've moved from ignoring it altogether or addressing it because of public health into the era of, whoops, I was flicking there without even knowing. Low-impact development is really about trying to mimic those natural hydrologic functions. We're trying to protect or we're trying to reestablish those functions that would occur in a pristine watershed but yet in our urban environment. And we do that through the capture and storage of rainwater. We do that through encouraging infiltration. We do that through slowing the flow. And also, while you do these things, you get secondary benefits of water quality treatment. Low-impact development is actually two things. Low-impact development is looking at site planning, how you lay out a site like a new development, how you look at how you lay that site out, non-structural, kind of the planning aspect is one piece. The other piece are a lot of these structural controls. The Appropriate Technology Coalition did a great job of putting up all sorts of examples. Loomis has a great example of some of the cisterns. Those are some of the technologies. But you're using how you plan a site and the techniques that you use to try to maximize how you're storing, infiltrating, evaporating, detaining runoff. So I'm going to give you one example of a site design. There's a lot of different types of site design. But if somebody's going to go and develop a new subdevelopment, let's say, this is an example that was done with Rick Harrison's site design where they were putting in a subdivision, and I know you can't see all the parcels here, but the original street design and the way that the homes were laid out created about 82 acres of public street. So again, we're talking about the creation of 82 acres of impervious area that's going to generate stormwater runoff, pollutants, high flows, etc. By looking at that site design, thinking very, very thoughtfully about how to maximize the need for the street and the mobility issue, but try to cut back on the amount of street, try to lay the home parcels a bit differently, they were able to cut down from 82 acres of public street down to 53 acres of public street. It was a 35% difference in impervious area. Number of homes stayed the same. So just by site planning, new development, this is one kind of technique where try to mimic and try to encourage those natural watershed functions. Once you've developed something with a certain kind of cookie cutter design, it's going to be a lot more difficult to come in with these other techniques that I'm going to talk about. Maximize it when you're doing a new design. Some of the techniques then that you can put in on the site level, again, there's a lot of examples here on the side on the poster boards, but it's bioswales, which I'll talk a bit about, permeable pavements, down here, downspout disconnects, you know, as Noah was talking about, getting that roof water out of the sewer system, rain, as Noah was And so we designed in a system of bioswales. So what you're looking at here is the original design where you've got these bioswales, and they're non-vegetated yet, so you can kind of just see the concept. And all these swales sort of interlock with each other. That means the water that's falling onto the street, which we made a little bit curvy just to go against DuPont, but we made it a little bit curvy for traffic calming. These swales are all connected to each other. Water coming off the homes and off the street goes into these swales. So here on the right, you have a picture of one of these swales that's completed. We had designed this to manage a fairly small storm event, but because of the soil and this, I think I'm picking this up from NOAA, the spongification of the soil, they've never had any runoff exit this block. It's managing all the stormwater. We had 300-year storm events, and not a drop came out of that block. Here's another picture of the street with the bioswale system. We're not going to get systems this lush in most of the Central Coast because we're more Mediterranean climate. But nevertheless, the systems can be very attractive, just a different plant palette. More lush in Seattle. Other types of bioswales. The one on the upper left is a curb bulb extension, and I know that Mary Fullwood hates that name, and we need to think of a new name because it just sounds horrendous. But a curb bulb extension is where you take a street where you already do have curb bulb and sidewalk, curb gutter sidewalk, and if you can see, the water comes along the curb as it generally would, but now you've created this little extension, this little bulb that bulges out from the sidewalk into the street, and the water comes in this little opening, and it goes through this little bioswale, gets water quality treatment, infiltration, all those kind of processes that we were talking about. And at the other end, there's another opening, so water that can't be infiltrated goes back into that gutter, goes back into the storm drain, but you have a lot less water and much cleaner water. The other example down on the lower right is a planting strip bioswale. We've used these more in very urban areas where you don't have the room in the street because of cars, buses, etc. So the water comes offline from the gutter, comes into the system. It takes the place in some ways of the planting strip, but you're still getting, you know, the vegetation and aesthetic of a planting strip. It's basically, you know, using one system of vegetation to meet two goals. It goes through this vegetated area and then exits back out into the system, less water, cleaner. So these are just a couple other kinds of designs of bioswales or bioretention. Then you've got permeable paving. Nice drawing, I think, over on the side on the poster board of some permeable paving. You've got several different types. There's sort of the modular grid type that a lot of times you'll see vegetation planted in. People tend to use this a lot in their driveways. It kind of looks nice. Then you've got concrete interlocking pavers. The lighter color is the concrete, and these little darker areas are actually holes that go down a truck or something, and the water is completely soaked in to the parking lot rather than running off. So these are good for stormwater management. Again, you get that groundwater recharge potentially. You get water quality treatment in the kind of upper layers of these systems, but they're also driving surfaces and walking surfaces, so it can handle, most of these can handle the weight of vehicles and even big vehicles, trucks. Even I'd say 5-10 years ago, there was a lot of scrutiny around various permeable pavings because they hadn't gotten it right yet in terms of being able to handle vehicular loads, but they're much better now and much cheaper. Here's permeable paving in parking lots. Parking lots are my big peeve, and so I really enjoyed NOAA's presentation. They're just a wasteland of impervious surface. But here's an example where the permeable paving was just used kind of at the front of where the vehicles park into the parking stall, and the lot is graded so that the flow goes off of the parking lots and into these permeable areas and soaks in. Another example is using that same concept, but also if you still have some runoff, making that runoff go into a curb cut so it's going into the planting strip area. I think old Spencer's lot, they could take some of those little areas where they were doing the plantings in the parking lot. If they could do a curb cut, get some of that water going into those sites, if the slope is right, that's how you're getting water in there to help enhance that vegetation. And then the lower left is just a plan view where we did a project up at a mall in Seattle where we actually planted these bio swales in this location. So instead of the pervious pavement, the bio swales were planted in here so that the flow would go into these bio swales and be treated. When we did this design for the developer of the mall, they didn't lose any parking spots with the design we were able to come up with, and they didn't have to do any detention vaults. They saved over $1 million. Just if you just want to look at it strictly economically, they saved a lot of money, but at the same time they were doing more of these restorative type watershed process protection of the nearby creek, Thornton Creek in this case. Downspout disconnection. This is one of the easiest things that people can do. I mean, you have to be careful to make sure you're not infiltrating right next to a building foundation always, but it's usually just just disconnecting the roof water that's coming down. Usually put a splash block so you're not eroding at that spot. Oftentimes it's combined with like a little rain garden. This is one that's also sort of a rain garden that's associated with it. In Portland, if you disconnect your downspout, they'll come check it out, give you a check for $50. I mean, it's the easiest incentive and sort of low-impact development technique that's out there. Rainwater harvesting. So now we get into collecting the rainwater aspect. I was really intrigued to talk to the Loomis folk back there about what sort of products they have available. We've got your rain barrels. Rain barrels, I mean, you saw Noah's calculation about how much water can actually come off of a rooftop. Rain barrels, you can't catch a lot of water, and then it's not a lot of water to use. We found that the soils held way more water than we ever thought. If you take 100 pounds of just sort of normal, I wouldn't say super clay soil, but if you add about a pound of composted material, amended soil, you get 4 additional gallons of water that you can hold by just adding a pound of compost. If you add 4 pounds of some kind of amended soil or compost, that same 100 gallons, you get 22 additional gallons of water that you can store. So when we're thinking about not losing our water resources and thinking about all the benefits that healthy soils bring, composting, mulching, etc., it's just the best. Same thing with the vegetation. Besides not using water for lawns, you use natural vegetation and you get all this microbial activity in the soils. You get all the roots. As the plants start growing, they create these interstitial spaces in the soil, and those spaces hold an incredible amount of water. As we watched some of our bioretention or bioswales projects maturing, we were holding more and more water every year, and we were scratching our heads, couldn't figure out why. Finally did some soils analysis and kind of a core sample and saw that the roots were just creating these holes in the system that was just holding everything. So the native vegetation is key. So the low impact development, I touched on the fact that you get these environmental benefits. We've been talking about it primarily for stormwater. That's really how low-impact development started. But you start getting into these other benefits, kind of this, let's start linking the silos concept, recharging groundwater, improving water quality, channel protection so, we don't get those blown-out channels that we've been showing you pictures of, conserving water, not using high-quality water because maybe you can use the rainwater, the stormwater, for landscape irrigation. Habitat in these systems, and improvement of air quality. But there's also other benefits. So it's not just the environmental. You get the economic benefits. Green-collar jobs. We're going to be hearing a lot, especially with Obama and the state of the economy, about green-collar jobs. The stimulus package included 20% of the funds going to green infrastructure. Imagine as these kinds of systems, for example, start getting built across the United States, there's essentially going to be stormwater landscapers, gardeners, who are going to be tending these systems. You're going to have more people creating products for cisterns, things like that. It's really a place where we're going to see a lot more job creation in this work. Increases property value. We had data in our projects that some of the homes increased in value by $20,000 versus the houses on the next block, and they sold faster. People want green homes. They want green streets, etc. You also get less money on the traditional stormwater system infrastructure. Those big tanks and things, that the way that we traditionally have done stormwater management, as soon as you start digging into the ground, it's a huge cost. Excavation vaults cost a lot of money. So if you can do something that's more on the surface, simpler, still does the trick, mulching, things like that, it's a lot cheaper. I mean, they're very nice to look at in general. You reduce the heat island effect, you know, walking along a hot black asphalt parking lot. As soon as you start getting a lot of vegetation in there, you start getting a cooling effect in those areas. Recreational value. Here's a picture of some kids playing on a green roof in a little vegetable garden in Battery Park City. Noise reduction, shade, windbreaks, and just neighborhood pride. People love these systems once they go in. I'm going to go quickly now, as we're getting close on our time, through the fact of how stormwater has this link to water supply. And by addressing water supply, we get into climate change and energy-saving issues. So we've got some of the cheapest water in the world. It's about $2 per 1,000 gallons. It's average nationally, but water is very cheap, and we use twice as much water per capita than folks in Europe. We're water hogs. But yet at the same time, we're getting population growth, increasing demand for that water. We've got sustained droughts occurring all over the country now. We have climate change that may be decreasing the snowpack, which for a lot of areas is their source of their drinking water. And water managers in 36 states right now anticipate severe water shortages by 2020. It's really pricking the ears up of all sorts of folks across EPA, national, state agencies, and thinking about water supply. This is a chart of domestic water use, and you probably can't see the numbers in the back or maybe even in the front. But the point of this being that we have all these potable water uses for high-quality water showers, dishwashers, baths, etc. And then we have uses where we use very high-quality water, but it's sort of questionable about whether we need that high of quality water to do the activity. Toilets is one. Clothes washers. I'm kind of on the line about clothes washers because I don't know. I kind of think you might need good, clean water for that. But and then outdoor uses. And the point being that the outdoor uses, again, this is sort of a national average, is 60% of our water supply. This is highly treated, processed water to water the gardens. And then if you look at things like the toilets, et cetera, then we're getting into the 70-80% of our use of water is really for needs that we don't need that high of quality of water. And then the link between water supply and energy use. This is a Northern California, Southern California chart. The primary cost of water is distribution, conveying it, and treating it, by far and large. You look at Northern California, and this is in energy consumption, kilowatt hours per million gallons. And just so you know, 1 kilowatt hour represents the fact that you can take a 100-watt light bulb and run it for 10 hours. That's 1 kilowatt. And so Northern California has kilowatt hours per million gallons. And then you look at Southern California. Southern California, because of the aqueduct, et cetera, huge cost in the supply and conveyance of that water, just getting it there. So the energy is costing a lot. If California could reduce their water demand by 10%, it could save 293 billion global warming by how we use water supplies. So on the left hand, you know, we've got this sort of decadent use of water. I mean, it's very highly valued, but we're sort of wasting it. And on the right hand side, we've got stormwater, which we're treating as a waste product, just kind of running out and causing environmental damage. So there's something kind of wrong with that picture. And so now we get into, you know, how can cisterns, low-impact development cisterns, help us address better stormwater management, but address the water supply, energy, CO2. Chesapeake Bay Foundation, they put in three large cisterns that they collected their roof runoff, and they used that water for their bathroom sinks, HVAC systems, fire suppression. They've had a 90% decrease in their potable water use. That's amazing. 73% of the water used in the building is from the cistern. Fuller Hall, Portland, Oregon. This is a mixed-use student housing, 62,000 square feet. They're essentially taking their roof runoff. It's coming down from the roof, and it's going through these downspout disconnects, hits a splash block in the public plaza, and then goes into these planter-type boxes, flows through there, and then goes down into the basement where it's collected. And they use that water in the underground cisterns. It's treated, and they use it to flush the toilets. They save about 100,000 gallons of potable water each year. Now, the thing is that there is starting to be a lot of emergence of new codes and what are the guidelines for using gray water and for using rainwater. Some of it, it's kind of different across the nation, but there needs to be some type of treatment, and not everybody's agreed on the level of treatment. It depends on the water using. But because it's new and nobody knows how to handle it, in Epler Hall, where they're using this reclaimed water to flush the toilets, there's a sign over each toilet that says, "Reclaimed water, do not drink." And I was like, well, I don't think you really need to be told that, I hope. But, you know, so as we build the standards, they'll know, you know, what signs should be put on. Okay, so a holistic approach to the environment brings us closer to these healthy watersheds, a sustainable future for us all. Getting more out of this mechanistic thinking, starting to link all those silos together, starting to think more about how the actions of things like low-impact development can have a very positive ripple effect. And linear thinking is like drinking wine. It should only be done in moderation. So everybody's goal next week is to not be doing very much linear thinking anymore. And that's it. Great.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Darla. Excellent, Dominic. And thank you to you all for coming out tonight. This has been a really excellent evening. Again, we'll be in Atascadero tomorrow at the Lake Pavilion. And I would like to take this opportunity to welcome you all to attend the third annual Slo County Water Fest event, which will be held this year, I'm very excited to say, in Morro Bay at The Rock on June 20th. That's Father's Day weekend and also International Surf Club and Surf Rider Foundation. Thanks again.